Frank Porter, as his nephew and subsequent mayor of Urakun, Jacob Wongbe, called him, is the narrator of the documentary Takeover by ethnographic filmmakers David and Judith McDougall, documenting the 1978 removal of the Uniting Church from the administration of the Urakun Mission and the assumption of control by the Queensland government under Premier Joe Bjelke-Petersen. I watched it again on SBS On Demand. You should too. It's the story of a great crime against a good people, a most wrongly maligned people, whom the outside world in the decades since has only known as a violent, drunken, incessantly fighting and hopeless people in the so-called Beirut of the bush. Takeover represents the beginning of their descent into hell. Almost 80 years after the Presbyterian missionaries helped the WIC through the transition from bush life to mission settlement living, the Queensland government under Bjelke-Petersen takes over the Urakun mission and destroys the future of a people. It is one of the worst crimes a government has done to an Indigenous people in the 20th century. Taken a good people from a situation of hope and good prospect and trashed them. Before the takeover, various churches administered these missions and others were directly administered by government. Previously, the Department of Native Affairs, and at the time of the takeover, the Department of Aboriginal and Islanders Advancement. This was the distinction between a mission and a government settlement, such as Yarrabah, Cherbourg, Woorabinda, or Palm Island. It wasn't Bjelke-Petersen's antipathy to missions being run by churches. After all, my own Hopevale mission was still being run by the Lutherans, and Joe was a former chairman of the mission board, responsible for its administration in the years after the Second World War. No, it was his particular antipathy to the Presbyterians, now the Uniting Church, for supporting the WIC people in their objection to bauxite mining on their homelands and their desire to decentralise from the mission and live on their homelands in the 1970s. And the evil machinations of that infamous and baleful bureaucrat, Paddy Killoran, who was the director in charge of their advancement in Queensland. The takeover was an act of gross political violence against a people. In 1975, the Queensland government passed special legislation, the Urakun Associates Agreement Act, to grant 1,905 square kilometres of the Urakun Aboriginal Reserve to a consortium of aluminium companies, the French company Pechenet, Billiton, and Tipperary. This legislation was similar to the laws that led to the burning beds of the Marpoon Mission a generation earlier. The terms of the agreement with the Urakun Associates were negotiated by Killoran as trustee for the Urakun Reserve. Killoran neither informed nor sought the agreement of the Urakun people in making this agreement. The chairman of the community council, Donald Pinekinner, supported by the church, launched a challenge in the Supreme Court of Queensland against Killoran, arguing he had breached his fiduciary duties to the Urakun people. Pinekinner won, but the government appealed to the Privy Council in London Killoran succeeded in this appeal, and the Urukun associates held on to their bauxite mining leases. 2 years later, Killoran and Bijelke Petersen moved against Pinekenna, his council, his people, and the church, resolving to take over the Uniting Church missions of Urukun and Mornington Island in the Gulf of Carpentaria. The takeover was pure vengeance. In the film, Killoran arrives in Urukun on a charter plane with his Minister for Aboriginal and Island Affairs, Charles Porter, grandfather of now Federal Minister Christian Porter, to meet with the Urukun people. They tell the assembled public meeting they are there not to consult with them about the government's takeover, but to inform them of a decision the government has already made. I watch the old footage of Urukun in 1979. I've never seen the people and the place like it. I was in year 9 at boarding school in Brisbane. I would make my first visit in another 11 years. I don't recognize most of the old people in the film. I see Francis, his brother Bruce, a young Gladys, and a young Stanley and Gideon, but the others are from an older generation, whom I would hear of but never meet. Old man Donald died before I first visited Urukun in 1990. I am struck by the intelligence and vitality of the Wik people in the film. I came to know the last of this Wik generation from Urukun, Edward River, Pomperau, Weeper South, Napranum, and Cohen. I assume the lady who is so obviously a leader is Geraldine, namesake of the missionary Bill Mackenzie's wife. The childless couple would stand in loco parentis of the Wik people for 40 years. That the Mackenzies helped the Wik people through the 20th century and by the 1970s stood them in as good a stead for the future as could have been hoped, I think, is clear. Geraldine Kowanka was testament to that. I'm also struck by how the Wik are led by their elders. It's obvious the young Gladys was emerging as a leader, but it is the mature men and women who are leading the fight against the takeover. The premature leadership of youth is not the case at this time. The older people know what is going on and are clear in their position that the church should remain and Urukun should continue to be a mission run by its council with the support of the church. The takeover becomes a national political issue, with the Commonwealth Government, through its Department of Aboriginal Affairs, under Minister Ian Viner, expressing support for the Urukun community's desire to have the Commonwealth assume responsibility for these missions. There are nervous moments throughout the story. When it is never certain, Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser's government would stick to the principled position it said it was committed to, that it would be guided by the self-determination of the Urukun people. The dispute between Bijelke Petersen and the Commonwealth drags on. The Commonwealth introduces a special law, the Aboriginal Councils and Associations Act 1976, which provides a mechanism for communities such as Urukun to come under the aegis of the Commonwealth Government. 11 years after the 1967 referendum, when the Commonwealth assumed legislative responsibility for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, here was the prospect that two Indigenous communities in Queensland would be able to bring themselves under the administrative jurisdiction of the Commonwealth rather than the state. This would be a crucial breakthrough and a potential pathway for the future. Communities having a primary relationship with the Commonwealth rather than the state. Communities funded directly by the Commonwealth rather than through the larcenous intermediation of the state. Viner talks a big game. There are reasons for optimism because Bjelke Petersen's position is indefensible, and the Arakoon people clearly want the church to remain. With federal legislation poised to provide a pathway out of the takeover, the film's closing scenes see the narrator sitting with his chairman and talking to the camera, anticipating the likelihood the Commonwealth will follow through on its promises. I know the old man's sense of humour. Of the prospect of victory, he is saying, they might celebrate with dancing. We'll have a big party. Traditional dance, island style, and then a waltz. Then these words appear. On April 7, 1978, within minutes of the passage of the federal legislation, Queensland announced the abolition of the Arakoon and Mornington Island Aboriginal Reserves. 4 days later, without further consultation with the community, the Prime Minister, Mr. Fraser, and the Queensland Premier, Mr. Bjelke Petersen, reached a new agreement in Canberra. Fraser capitulated to the Queenslanders, and the Arakoon people are betrayed. The takeover proceeds. The concessions made by Bjelke Petersen will compound the violence of the takeover. Arakoon would be assimilated into Queensland's local government system with the passage by the Queensland Parliament of the Local Government Aboriginal Lands Act 1978. And a 50-year lease of the Aboriginal Reserve would be held under the trusteeship of the elected council. The transition from the community council, supported by the Uniting Church, to a mainstream model of local government, replete with the mayoral robes and gavel, and the complete control of the Department of Local Government, would become a disaster for Arakoon and its sister mission, Mornington Island, to this day. There's no reason my own and my older brother's generation and those following should have been predisposed to alcoholism. Nothing in the history of our families or our community made alcohol and addiction to it a symptom of underlying personal problems or trauma. I know all these people. I knew who their parents and grandparents were, and they knew mine. I'd been in most of their homes and stayed over in many of them, went camping with them and hunting and fishing, and travelled to football games and rodeos and church functions. And you're trying to tell me there was something in their backgrounds that predestined them to the misery of alcoholism? That they were self-medicating some pain in their lives? That just didn't gel with my knowledge of the people who became victims of alcoholism and the damage it caused their families and their bodies. Their childhoods and the families and grandfamilies from which they came could not have put them in better stead. I think their children and grandchildren could certainly point to damaged childhoods. They could make a more compelling case for trauma and injury, but not my generation. We had sober parents. And whatever other latent and hidden problems there might have been, we didn't have the problem of the grog being out of control when we were kids. We were truly the blessed generation. This is why the Swedish psychiatrist Niels Bergerot's explanation of the dynamics of addiction epidemics was so compelling to me, that the symptom theory is wrong, that addiction epidemics only require the availability of the addictive thing, money to acquire it, time to use it, the example of use in one's immediate environment, and permissive social norms. The symptom theory becomes a convenient fiction for individuals, their codependents and enablers, and their communities, and an entire people. So I cannot avoid confronting my brothers, and by extension, my people, with the refusal to accept that alcohol is some kind of inevitable problem for our people. Rather, it's the consequence of availability, money, and free time. And this is what started with young men in the 70s and spread wider in the 80s. Young men, and later older men, and young women drink to have fun. And alcohol is at first, and for quite some time afterwards, enjoyable. This is not the self-medication of pain, but the natural hedonism that alcohol unlooses in all who imbibe. The calamity of the 78 takeover and its consequences for the future of Arakun people soon became apparent when it was no longer the successors of Reverend Bill McKenzie responsible for supporting them in their self-management, but rather the minions of Bajelki Peterson's Minister for Local Government and much else, Russ Hinds. McKenzie's Presbyterians had a paternalistic love for the WIC people. Hinds's bureaucrats had contempt for them, and they've crushed them for 40 relentless years since. The local government structure was and still is a disastrous institution of governance imposed upon the WIC and the Mornington Islanders, and 20 years after, upon every other community in Queensland, which cut across their social and cultural leadership and debilitated them, leaving the community susceptible to the control and manipulation of the Queensland government and its bureaucracy. You want to know at whose feet the disasters of Arakun of the past four decades should be laid? The Queensland government and its manipulative control of the local government through its administration. Hinds and his department, having imposed the mainstream model upon a community living on communal lands with no rate base and too small to fund its local government, saw a source of revenue in plain sight. The revenue was in the form of social security payments from the Commonwealth to individuals and families. How to convert this money into local government revenue? The answer was for these local governments to own and operate liquor canteens that could convert social security into local government revenue. But the Arakun people did not want a canteen. A number of plebiscites and numerous public meetings opposed it. The young Uniting Church Minister John Adams, who is in the background of the takeover film, tells me he visited every household in the mission to survey their views on a canteen. Even drinkers, those who went to the mining town of Weipa to drink or brought in sly grog, knew what would come from a canteen and were not in favour. The council was at first opposed, but the pressure from the State Department through their Bwana on the ground was unrelenting. himself an alcoholic, like most of these characters, and they eventually succumbed. The Adult Education Center became the new outlet for liquor in the previously dry community in 1985, from education to drinking. The story of Urukun's sister mission, Mornington Island, is told by the late anthropologist David McKnight in his 2002 book, From Hunting to Drinking, in which he too identified the disaster wrought by the Shire Council structure on the people of Mornington and its adjacent islands. This is the sociologist Robin Room's summation of McKnight, David McKnight. The author of From Hunting to Drinking is a London-based anthropologist who for 30 years has been studying the Aboriginal peoples of Mornington Island in the Gulf of Carpentaria off the northern coast of Australia. He offers a detailed account of the changes that have occurred over the last century in the islands, which have a present-day population of about 900, starting with a long period of paternalistic oversight by a Presbyterian mission. The wider world of white Australia gradually impinged as men went to work on cattle stations, ranches on the mainland, and children were put into dormitories to enforce schooling. Although the changes gradually cut the Aboriginal population off from features of their ancestral culture, McKnight does not see the population as demoralized in the period before the 1970s. The picture changes in McKnight's presentation after the 1970s, as alcohol became legally available to Aborigines and readily available to them with the opening of a canteen operated by the local government in 1976. At the same time, greater financial resources become available to community members, primarily in the form of unemployment benefits, government work programs, and other welfare payments. The result has been a long, continuing binge, with recurrent violence, community disruption, and ill health. While the materials McKnight draws on are primarily ethnographic, the statistics he has compiled and estimated are dramatic indeed. About half the income of the inhabitants of the islands, he estimates, is spent on beer, corresponding roughly to 5 cans a day, 6 days a week, per drinker. In the period of 1980 to 2000, McKnight counts 14 homicides and 26 suicides involving Mornington Islanders, a rate 34 times that of the state of Queensland as a whole. The unravelling of Urukun began in earnest, with grog now a full-blown epidemic. The frequency of drinking increased. The volumes consumed increased. The numbers of drinkers increased. Cohorts of drinkers changed to include young women and older men. And the violence changed in frequency, severity, and senselessness. The money flowing into the coffers of the council became a flood as alcohol coursed through the livers and kidneys of the people, whose bodies had become laundries for federal welfare checks. And in too many wombs of young women drinking, fetuses started developing fetal alcohol syndrome for the first time. By the time I came to know the WIC, the canteen had been raging for 5 remorseless years. The grog and violence were rife. David Marr reported on the unfolding disaster in a classic ABC Four Corners story called Six Pack Politics in 1991. You should watch that too. Ma reported that a new council headed by new mayor Alison Wooler was elected on a platform to close the canteen. Alison was one of the next generation of leaders after Geraldine Cowanka and Frank Porter, mission educated, steeped in WIC culture, but sophisticated about the outside world and politics. Her generation threw up as many talented people as previous ones, but Alison, Gladys, and Norma were the power trio, committed, fearless, and smart. They reminded me of Galarrwuy Yunupingu and that bridging generation who straddled the old classical world and the future. Today, Alison's daughter, Kerry Tamwoy, is the mayor of the same local government, grappling with Arakoon 30 years after her mother had first become so anxious about the effects of the canteen on her people. Grappling with the children of the children. The babies born into the grog and unremitting violence themselves become mothers and fathers to the next generation. With a neurological and mental legacy instilled from their conception through the years of their growth to adulthood. There is a spectrum from healthy babies born to sober mothers and families that shielded them as best they could from the social chaos of the Arakoon township through to children with varying degrees of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and an all too prevalent exposure to trauma from earliest childhood. This same story played out on Mornington Island and in all of the remote communities of the Cape. In his 2009 book, The Politics of Suffering, Peter Sutton, the anthropologist and linguist of WIC society and culture over many decades, pointed out that compared to other Indigenous societies across the country, and indeed compared to societies within Cape York Peninsula, like my Gugu-Yimithir people of Hopevale, the WIC were left largely unscathed in the colonial period. They were little impacted by frontier conflict and dispersal. Their vast lands were set aside as Aboriginal reserves early, and the Presbyterians provided sufficient shelter and structure during the transition from bush to settlement life in the 20th century. The WIC were able to retain their languages and other elements of their classical culture, including their rich ceremonial and ritual life, which Mackenzie did not try to displace and destroy, not least the ability to hunt and gather livelihood from their abundant environment. They learned to labour in cattle and other local industries and activities necessary to sustain life in a mission. Their colonial trauma started late. In the actions of the Queensland government, with the imposition of a bauxite mining lease in 1975, the resultant takeover of the mission in 1978, and the forced introduction of the canteen in 1985. Sutton counts the numbers, pre and post 1985. One homicide and one suicide before the canteen, and many dozens of each after. No statistics tell the story more profoundly than these. They are echoed by other statistics, hospital presentations for violent injuries, child neglect and removal, magistrate, district and Supreme Court convictions, adult imprisonment, juvenile detention, disabilities from birth, and acquired disabilities, mental health problems, and psychoses. These statistics of intrafamilial and intracultural violence are born of the political violence of the Queensland government. Visited upon the Wik people and the community of Aurukun by state administrations run by Bjelke Petersen's National Party before 1989 and subsequent Labor and Conservative administrations to the present. Beattie and Bly did things that countered this legacy. But Labor administrations from Goss to Palaszczuk were as culpable as their Conservative counterparts in this story of political violence at the hands of the state. From the beginning, I made common cause with the people of Aurukun. Their leaders always wanted a better life for their people. When we focused on tackling grog, the Wik people were at the forefront of limiting alcohol supply. The introduction of alcohol management plans was supported by Aurukun leaders. Premier Peter Beattie's measures saved lives and dramatically reduced harm. The medical journal The Lancet published research by the Royal Flying Doctor Service showing reductions in injury presentations from violence. Beattie's successor, Anna Bly, made further improvements when her government barred councils from operating liquor outlets. Bly responded to our welfare reform agenda by establishing the Family Responsibilities Commission, comprising elders who were empowered to intervene where parents failed in their obligations to children and families. This is when Neville Puchamanka became mayor of the Aurukun Shire Council. He was an extraordinary man, around my age, who was able to transcend the family conflicts in Aurukun and provide a level of stability that was lacking before and after his time. Neville wanted welfare reform for his community and was closely involved in negotiations with governments. With his deputy, Phyllis, Neville travelled with me to the United States in 2009 to visit charter schools and schools offering direct instruction. We returned from America with a plan for a new model of primary schooling in Aurukun and the small community of Cowan, which would be called the Cape York Aboriginal Australian Academy. By 2010, our plan to pick up the pieces from the legacy of the takeover and to rebuild the Wik people had three elements. The first was welfare reform. The second was family responsibilities. And the third was a good education for the children. Most of what we were doing was not new, but was rather about rebuilding things that had been destroyed since the takeover. I looked at old newsletters describing the Aurukun school in the 1970s, with photographs of a young Stanley and Mary Ann working as teachers' aides, and a school that looked like the kind of school we were rebuilding with the academy. The same was true of tackling alcohol and mandating family responsibilities. Neville wanted Aurukun to be a place where children were safe within their families and people were as healthy and strong as they once had been. Neville had a kindness and a sense of calm that was amazing to me, given the social and cultural situation he was responsible for. He was the leader Aurukun needed to face up to the challenge of reconstruction. Then, in April 2012, I received the news he had collapsed and could not be revived. He was only 50. This is when the trouble started. Aurukun's best hope was gone. His successor would play an active role in the second takeover of Arakun.